Welcome to Business Watch here on Business Day TV. The collapse of the giant Chinese property developer Evergrande, the purchase of Newcastle United by the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, the unprecedented shortage of truck drivers in the UK, skyrocketing fuel prices across most parts of the world, Europe and Asia, and the seemingly unwavering popularity of cryptocurrencies despite its obvious flaws, and the incredible rise of global inequality, all in the context with the spectre of inflation. These are just a few examples of the new headlines that we're observing on a daily basis. It's a smorgasbord of chaos, disruption and uncertainty that's underscored by the diminishing desire of the West to promote global democracy and ideals. Now, why are these things happening now at this time in history? What is the real underlying cause of this wave of discontent and disruption? And what is the logical conclusion of these significant social and economic trends? These are just a few of the questions that have preoccupied authors of a fascinating page-turner of a new book entitled The End of Money, The Great Erosion of Trust in Banking, China's Minsky Moment and the Fallacy of Cryptocurrency, now available in all good bookstores. And I'm joined by one of the book's authors, David Buckham, CEO of Monocle, who's stuck in Dubai because of the travel chaos that has been ushered in by the new COVID variant. David, I've got to commend you for producing a book that's so well researched, and it really reads like it could be a thriller of pure fiction, that at times you have to actually stop yourself and remind yourself that everything you write about is real, has happened, or is happening. And this is really the mirror that you hold up for us to peer into. Firstly, just tell us a little bit more about your background and the inspiration for the book.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on the show here. So I have worked in banking or consulting to banks or banking itself for the last 25 years. And there have been repeated failures of banks throughout my tenure in banking, starting from the small South African investment bank in the late 90s. I had studied mathematics, a BSc in maths, and then a master's in English, and had become an investment banker and a trader. That bank failed in the A2 banking crisis after the Sambo liquidity crunch. And then I went on to start Monocle and had a first-hand sight of banks crashing in Iceland. We had a lot of work in Iceland, Landsbankinn, and then Fjonia Bank, a 100-year-old bank. And the question that I asked was, how frequent is this? Frequently is this occurring? And surely, if this is the organ, the brain that is supposed to deliver capital and liquidity in the most efficient way to the body economic, so to speak, the limbs of the body economic, the different industries, then surely it should be more efficient and should be safer. And roughly speaking, like a Formula One grid where only four cars ever finish. So that was the question that plagued me, is why are we in such an industry that's so dangerous? And following the 2008 financial crisis, I promised myself that I would never again ignore what is so obvious, which is that the industry of banking is far more dangerous and far more unstable than we realize or than we accept. So about a year ago, during the June-July period, when the Banker magazine releases its top 1,000 banks, it's a list of the top 1,000 banks by assets and by risk-weighted assets. We noticed that the top four banks by risk-weighted assets and by assets are all Chinese banks, which doesn't make sense. And then we began to dig. That was the way the book started. It took us a lot further than that.
So that's the inspiration, and there's so much just to unpack inside that inspiration. We've seen, despite the various iterations of Basel I, which was less than 20 pages, all the way up to the tome that is now Basel III and beyond, how heavily regulated banks are, yet they still collapse, and we'll come to that. But a central ideal of the book is that democracy is in decline, a failure of liberal democracy as we know it that has led to a rise in authoritarianism. Can you just elaborate on this?
Yeah, so Michael, what we noticed is that there's been a steady erosion of trust in banking, which then leads people to turn away from traditional banking towards something called decentralized finance, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and these ideas gain traction. And it's a long, steady erosion of trust that starts with kind of 1980-style Wall Street greed, and then the continuous failure of banking and finance, and bailouts. And simultaneously, you've got this very obvious thing that's happening in the world where you've got fewer democracies and more authoritarian regimes. Even recently, you've got South Sudan being taken over by a military dictatorship. You've got Belarus extremely aggressive, trying to pick a fight with Europe on the Polish border. You've got the possible invasion of Ukraine. You've got 17 missionaries being abducted a month ago in Haiti. We know where they are. The guys want $1 million per missionary, and no one does anything. And you've got China becoming increasingly belligerent, and the complete failure of democracy in Hong Kong. And the question is, which causes which, or are they just correlated? And our thesis in the book, The End of Money, Michael, is that actually the erosion of trust in the financial system leads to, is a great cause, maybe a significant portion of the cause of the lack of belief in the ideals of liberal democracy, and therefore the rise of authoritarianism. So that's our thesis, is that you can draw a line from the failure of trust in the one to the lack of freedom in the political sphere.
And there was a correlation isn't necessarily causation, but I think what you've done in the book is you've spent a lot of time and go into some detail around researching how these things do play out. And you've also spent a lot of time focusing on the increase in global money supply and all this liquidity that we've seen injected into the world by central banks like the Fed and the ECB. Just give us a little bit more detail on the role that this vast sum of money, M1, M2, M3 money supply, is having in the world.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a really interesting problem, which is that many market commentators, I feel, shy away from talking about this problem, is that the sheer volume of money in US dollars in the world is something like four times more than it was 15 years ago. So pre the financial crisis, M2 money supply was three or four times less than the money that's in the world today. And the reason is because the financial crisis was so severe that the financial intermediation system completely seized up and the interbank market system completely seized up. So banks were not lending to each other. So the theory that the Fed had, and in turn the ECB, was to pump the market full of money by buying toxic debt off banks' balance sheets, which they started to do, and they called it quantitative easing. The thing is whenever they try to slow it down, the market reacted very badly. So the inverse of that, or what you can see, how you can read that problem in terms of numbers, is to look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet. The size of the Fed's balance sheet has gone from like $700 billion in 2003, 2004 to near $15 trillion today. So that reflects how much treasuries they've bought from the banks, thereby putting money into the market. So the world is awash with money. The reason that the price of the stock markets, the stock market valuation. So for example, if you take price to sales, so you take the S&P 500 and you take the total market value of the S&P 500 companies in 2008, their total market cap divided by their total revenue would have been one, that ratio would have been around one, meaning the amount of value of the top 500 companies in the S&P index is roughly equal to their sales. That value is now three. That's a direct result of there being 3 to 4 times more money in the world. It's got nowhere to go. It's like water. It will go into the places that are the easiest to go, which is the stock market, Bitcoin. Bitcoin was only invented in 2008. It's now $3 trillion value. So the problem in a world that's awash with money is eventually you get inflation, which is what we're seeing. And money starts to become, relatively speaking, more meaningless.
And that is a central theme that runs back to the lack of trust that we see in the traditional financial system. Within that kind of framework, money becomes meaningless. People start wondering what the future of money might be. And we see the rise of alternatives like cryptocurrencies. And you dedicate a chapter to that. But I'm getting ahead of myself on that point. I want to stay on the inflation issue for a little bit longer because we're seeing it all over the place. Asset prices have completely disconnected from fundamentals, and none more so than those on the very speculative edge of the tech spectrum. And we've seen those sell off quite substantially just recently as we see something of a rotation away from growth into value. Clearly, the smart money asset managers around the world are worried about the consequences of this rapid increase in money supply. What do you see as the major consequences?
I think there will be inflation. The problem with money supply is that it's much harder to take money out of the system than it is to put it in. So tapering is just meaning less new money. That's all that tapering means. It doesn't mean less money on a nominal basis. It just means they're going to stop making new money, which finally Jerome Powell has acceded to in the face of the highest inflation numbers in the US in 30 years. I think you will see inflation, and I would probably surmise an increase in inflation, and you'll see wage inflation in across the board, not only in truck drivers, but also in ICT workers. We're already seeing that in the US. We're seeing that in South Africa as well. Some people are tapping out of the workforce as well. So you're going to see significant wage inflation. And then the cost of certain goods, of certain foods, will also experience a massive inflation, way more than you would expect out of the basket of goods. I am concerned that this will also lead to kind of social disruption. And we look to the 1930s as an example of that. The time in history where there was this level of inequality and inflation, and parochial thinking in terms of political borders, for example, what's happening with Belarus and Poland. The only example that's, well, the example that's most prominent is the late 20s, early 30s. So these are some of the things that we should take into account. I'm not saying that there will be a great collapse or that there will be the end of the world. I mean, obviously the title of the book is The End of Money, but we mean it as not the impermanence of money. We mean it more as a lens through which to interpret the world. And we speak about these things, inflation, we speak about the rise of authoritarianism. And I think it's something to be afraid of and cautious about. Not necessarily that it's a given. Definitely
invest. One needs to be able to understand the financial history in order to be able to at least paint scenarios about what a potential future might portend. And none of us have a crystal ball, David, and I think we're living through very uncertain times because we've never tried this globally in terms of this unprecedented money printing, and we haven't seen it allied to this kind of rise of authoritarianism. I certainly took the book, The End of Money, the title, to be more of a play on Francis Fukuyama's The End of History. And as we know, you know, very famously, when Fukuyama declared the end of history at the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was anything but. And if anything, we've just seen a rise of a new Cold War, effectively, with China and Russia on the one axis, and the US increasingly shirking its global responsibility on the other side of that axis. I mean, in the book, you do cover a large amount of financial history just to justify this idea of a loss of trust in the financial system. Why do you believe it was so critical in this context to really understand where we're coming from? And you do rather ironically, trace the original sin back to the Nixon era?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. And Nixon intervened in, essentially attempted to intervene in the monetary system, much in the same way that Erdogan is intervening in the Turkish monetary system. And Nixon is, of course, vilified for the Watergate affair. But the Nixon shock is what they call it in 1974, which was where France became agitated that the US wasn't playing by the rules in terms of the dollar standard and making sure that there were the gold standard, that there was sufficient gold to back the issuance of US dollars. And that was where money uncoiled itself, so to speak, from something hard like gold, and it became it started to float and go into the ether, and that's really where you could say the origin of the problem began. And that's also where the great project of the European Union and of the United Nations and the great global project of liberal democracy just started to begin to unravel. It really unravels significantly in the 1990s, but it all begins after that great period. So after the Second World War, you have most of the world going, we would like that to never happen again. We do not want to go through a world war. But by the 1970s, the 1980s, the engine room of liberal democracy, where it was self-evident in the 1980s that if a country was not yet free, it was nevertheless going to be free. It was self-evident when, Reagan sent airborne troops into Panama to extract Manuel Noriega for drug trafficking. He was the president of Panama. He was brought back, held in court for a trial, and then imprisoned for the rest of his life. And, you know, today, I don't see any helicopters flying over my shoulder trying to get to Port-au-Prince to, you know, get these poor missionaries out of Haiti. That loss of idealism in the liberal democratic project that was post-World War II to make sure that we never suffered under a totalitarian regime again, that was eroded slowly, so that today people don't even think that it's a big deal that you can't vote in Saudi Arabia, or that women, the withdrawal from Afghanistan has gone politically relatively unnoticed. Yet it is one of the greatest failings of the modern Western system. So we believe that this begins with the Nixon shock.
And China is currently doing exactly that. It's exporting its authoritarian worldview via its renewed financial and technological clout. I mean, just the other month we had President Xi, who's now president for life, ensconced in Chinese thought in the constitution there, saying we need to do more as the Chinese Communist Party to share with the world the success of Chinese communism. And in the End of Money, you've done some seriously in-depth research on the Chinese banking system, and you mentioned it earlier, which was really the progenitor of this, to say, look at how much it's grown by. What does the future hold for China, and specifically its banking system, based on that research?
Yeah. So at the time when we started doing the research, it was not socially acceptable to critique China in any way, shape, or form, to the extent that, for example, in Australia, there was a backlash against the Prime Minister for questioning why the WHO was not able to investigate the origins of COVID. But nevertheless, in the Banker magazine and in the income statements and balance sheet of the Chinese banks, you can add it together. And the following comes out is that the four largest Chinese banks are the four largest banks in the world. They're bigger than JP Morgan or HSBC by a long way. And the total assets, that's the total balance sheets of Chinese banks as of the end of 2020, was $49 trillion, and Chinese GDP is somewhere between $13 and $17 trillion, depending on which PPP metric you use. US GDP is $20-21 trillion, and bank assets are, say, $22-23 trillion. So you got 110% versus 350%. A large economy like China's with a 350% bank assets to GDP ratio is dangerous. It is way too big. Historically, we know that this is overinflated. And we discovered that, Michael, quite a substantial portion of debt is not even on the Chinese bank's balance sheets. It's held inside corporations called AMCs, which were built to take bad debt off of the large Chinese financial institutions' balance sheets. This has been going on for more than 20 years. So we believe that the dissonance between the Chinese banking system and the glorification, so to speak, of the Chinese society has advanced massively over the last 20 years, primarily driven by investment by the government, which has been driven by massive amounts of debt.
Debt, yeah.
The problem is that it's gone way too far, way too far. And we believe that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, has realized this and has begun to try to put out fires or social unrest. And it's one of the reasons for the clampdown on Hong Kong.
Would you also see it, because there's been a lot of focus here in South Africa because of Naspers is holding in Tencent on what all the regulation means, and we've seen an inordinate amount of clampdown of the heavy hand of the Chinese Communist Party on industry, on Ant's founder Jack Ma as well. At one stage, people were saying, "Where is Jack Ma?" Unfortunately, he is he's still around. I mean, it wouldn't be unusual for this regime to ensure that dissidents or those who are against it are silent. How do you read all of that? And importantly, the consequence, not only for us here in South Africa, but for the world, if we're to start to see an unwind of this debt-fueled Chinese economic growth.
So you would have seen the recent statement by the Chinese government that they want to delist Didi. This would be the largest event of its kind and the most significant event. And this was just in the last few days. And there are two main reasons that the Chinese Communist Party would wish to delist Didi or wish to bring someone like Jack Ma to their heel. And the two reasons are, on the one hand, there's a data issue for them. So Didi will have mapping data of the Chinese landscape, and this is regarded as a security threat. The idea that data could be held in offshore locations or could be accessible by Western counterparts is one of the reasons we see a lot of clampdown on tech. The other main reason is that they are wishing to return to the communist ideology that everyone gets a fair share of, it's not intrinsically a capitalist ideology.
Common prosperity, I think they've nicknamed it.
Correct. So you would have seen a number of these billionaires making enormous gifts back to the Chinese Communist Party of like half of their wealth of their own volition, in the state media, because there's going to be in a, also, for example, the CEO of Evergrande, there was a big show of him, selling his jets to help pay for the next bond payment. What will happen, I think, is that there'll be the idea of a Chinese billionaire. And by the way, there's a lot of Chinese billionaires. There's been a 60% increase in Chinese billionaires in the last year, just alone. This is also covered in the book, The End of Money. So basically, we think that there will be fewer and fewer exceptional Chinese billionaires running exceptional tech firms, and those investments will become far less attractive to Westerners. Anyone invested in China, of course, will disagree with me, but if you're already invested, The problem is that the Chinese authorities do not want the average Chinese citizen who's now going to suffer from the iniquity of inflation or from not being able to, for example, get the same quality of life that they were hoping for, because there is no more money. They've run out of the ability to borrow. There will come a reckoning internally, and they don't want to have a Mark Zuckerberg-like figure to look at and go, no, but that's not fair. That's not egalitarian. That's not part of our ideology. Common prosperity is our ideology.
And sadly, that's all the time we have, David, because you then also, in a chapter that I believe was rewritten a couple of times because of its centrality to all of this in cryptocurrencies, you do take a very critical look on what the rise of cryptocurrencies actually mean and this innate loss of trust in traditional financial systems. So we're going to have you back on the show to talk about the cryptocurrency part of the book as well. That's all the time we have. David Buckham, everyone, thank you very much, CEO of Monocle, co-author of a fascinating page-turner of a new book entitled The End of Money, The Great Erosion of Trust in Banking, China's Minsky Moment, and the Fallacy of Cryptocurrencies. You've been watching Business Watch with me, Michael Avery, on Business Day TV.